So we are going to now begin a discussion on wage theories, which is the second chapter in this particular subject. So wage theories are basically models related to determining the wages and salaries of individuals in organizations and have been in practice since a very long time. So we will look at the objectives of this chapter before we begin our core discussions. So here you will understand the economic theory of wages. So various theories related to the wages and salaries will be discussed. We'll also look at the motivational theories. So a separate class of theory exists apart from the economic models, which can be classified as motivational theories, which we shall discuss. Now, before we end the chapter, we're also going to look at the process of putting these theories into practice. So these are the core objectives of this particular chapter. So according to the modern theory of wages, the wages are nothing but the price of services rendered by a labor to the employer. Correct? Like, let's say if there's, you know, a housekeeping staff that you've employed for your organization. Now, what do they basically do? They do the cleaning work. Okay, they wash the toilets. They provide you with water when required. They send you the tea and coffee. So these are some things that they do. So they work for a specific 8 or 9 hours in the organization, and they are paid certain wages. So they are paid on an hourly basis, which is computed as a salary, which is accumulated at the end of the month. The wage theories proposed in the past, surprisingly, still many of them hold up today, correct? So this is what is an interesting fact, and thus we will, you know, begin our discussions with certain, old theories as well. Now, how much and which basis the wages should be paid to the workers for the services rendered by them has actually been a subject matter of a lot of deliberation, a lot of debate, a lot of concern amongst the economic thinkers. Now, as you'll come to know, as the chapter progresses, there are several merits and several drawbacks related to each of the theories that shall be discussed. Yeah, so that will give you a clear perspective, a clear idea, and it will simplify this particular point provided here. So what's this done? It has given birth to several wage theories. So the wage theories are nothing but the models on the basis of wages are determined. Yeah, so we will look at those. Over here, let's make a mention of the pre-industrial society. It's important to understand what happened before industrialization took place in England. Okay, so in this particular era or period known as the pre-industrial society, the role and position of the laborers were commonly prescribed by customs or by the law. Now, what do we mean by customs? It is like the existing customs of that specific region. Like Germany might have different customs than India, correct? India might have different customs than the United States and so on. So we have some practices and customs or by the law of the land, correct? Now, at times there was a role like a master and a servant, which can be determined by a certain custom. That the servant may not have anything in cash. They might be given an accommodation. They might be given some food to eat and so on. It might also be like an apprentice and a master relationship, where the master does not pay the apprentice but gets certain work done and validates the work, the quality of the work. So this was usually what happened in the pre-industrial society or the era. Now, today we have made a big progression in the last 200-250 odd years, and the concept of the corporation has come into being. Now, along with the corporation, another powerful entity which we have come to know as the trade union has come into existence, and these are the modern social inventions representing the employer and the employee relationship. And the wage contracts in the Western industrial societies are frequently arrived at through collective bargaining or through arbitration by third parties. Huh? So gone are the days when we had, very obsolete or outdated practices. Today, everything is determined by how much money or remuneration is paid. And there are certain things like collective bargaining, which we saw earlier in the last chapter, or through arbitration. Arbitration is nothing but, following a certain resolution pattern by a third party, which also might involve some amount of legal course. So these are usually referred to as subsistence theory of the late 18th and the early 19th centuries. Now, what do we mean by subsistence? Subsistence is the basic survival on the provided resources, no more. All right. So there are many theories which are centered around this particular concept. Then we see a progression where the wage fund or the wages fund theory of the mid 19th century came into the beginning, and then the marginal productivity theory of the very late 19th and 20th centuries, and of course the bargaining power theory. So these are some of the prominent theories which have come to evolve over the past few centuries. However, there are also the surplus value theory, the residual claimant theory, and behavioral theories. So we are going to, in this chapter, explore, understand, and discuss various important theories which are determinant in calculating the wages. So the subsistence theory, now this is one of the oldest theories that we have. It's a classical theory. Now, what is the basis for this theory? What is believed is that in the long run, the laborers would tend to, require enough food, okay? So wages would tend to equal to enough food, clothing, and shelter to maintain existence. So it's a classical roti, kapda, and makan. So if you have enough to eat, you have proper clothes to wear, functional clothes, nothing luxurious, and you have a functional residence to live under, a roof, okay, it is sufficient. And this is also known as the iron law of wages. So here we are not looking at any sort of extra bit or any sort of a luxury. So if somebody is aspiring to buy a lovely car, an aesthetic car, or a modern painting, or they want to indulge in a holiday abroad, they wouldn't be a part, okay? That wouldn't be allowed in this, hence known as an iron law. So people were expected to get only so much which is important for their survival, not more. Hence it is known as a subsistence. So subsistence is enough to go by, like the concept of subsistence farming, where people will only farm their vegetables to have them for food, nothing more. So if the wages rose above the subsistence level, the prosperity of the workers would increase the population. So this is an assumption, okay? So this, students, is an assumption that if there is an increment of wages which is undue, it would increase the population and it would thereby increase the supply of the labor. Now what would happen? This would have a suppressing or a depressing effect on the wages themselves and naturally bring them down as per the economic law of supply and demand. So if supply increases substantially, what would happen? The wages would go down because then there would be too many people for a limited amount of jobs. Similarly, wages below the subsistence level would starve certain workers, others won't marry, all right? So if I have no means of earning, how can I sustain a family? How can I get married and have a family? So these are some of the basic premises under the subsistence theory. Now remember, this theory was in practice during the very early ages of the Industrial Revolution. We are talking basically of the early 18th century, where there were not many industries. It was just a simple progression over the agricultural practices that existed. Yeah. So hence this particular theory came into being. Now over here we have a graphical representation to make us understand this theory. So here if you see, the demand and supply of the labor has been measured on the OX axis. If you notice over here, this is the OX or the horizontal axis. Now over here, there is less labor and there's more labor. The labor numbers, they go on increasing. Like for example, today if let's say an L&T publishes for one of its factories, locations, they need 5,000 blue-collared laborers, all right? And tomorrow after, or let's say after 15 days, they say, now we don't want those numbers. We've already had a sufficient number of recruitments. We only want 100. So the number of laborers would go on increasing and decreasing. Here it's low, it's over here, it's high. On the OW, okay, on the OY axis, which is the vertical axis, is plotted the rate of the wages going from a low to a high again, as you can see over here. Now, what is subsistence level over here? As you can see, the subsistence level is the OW. This particular line drawn is known as the subsistence level. As you can see, it is neither too high, neither too low. So at OW, the wage or rate supply is known to be perfectly elastic. Okay, it's neither high, neither low. Since the supply of labor is perfectly elastic, the wage rate neither can fall below OW nor can increase above the level of OW. They balance, they tend to balance. So if the labor increases, what happens? The wage rate comes down. This is meant by elastic. Huh? So there's an elasticity. So it's like the stretch of a rubber band, it's elasticity. Just imagine if the labor, okay, so the labor is increasing. So see what happens? It brings down the wage rate up to a certain level, up to the level of the subsistence, which is nothing but OW. Okay, so this is, although demand increases from DD to DD1, okay, D1, yet the wage rate remains the same at OW. So see, if there is a shift in this particular DD, there's a subsequent shift here. But what happens if this is pulled up? This subsequently also increases and the wage rate is lowered, correct? So the wage rate is at the subsistent wage level itself. You can also pause this and you can also take a deep look at the diagram to make further sense, or you can replay this bit or this particular part to understand this economical concept. The next part, we look at some more aspects. Now here we look at why is this theory not completely logical. It has also been criticized by several economists. The first basis for criticism is that this particular theory, okay, the subsistence theory of wages, explains the wages from a narrow perspective and from only one side, which is the supply side. It tends to ignore the demand side, correct? So if you noticed in the last particular diagram, it was like the supply going on the horizontal axis, but there was no mention of another critical dimension, which is usually the demand. So for example, let's suppose L&T requires 10,000 employees, okay, in the next maybe 2 years, and they are all blue collared workers, but it's for a very skilled and a hazardous process, and they are going to be deputed somewhere in, you know, let's say either China or maybe Southeast Asia, where they will stay away from their family in testing conditions. Do you really think that the wages will go down in this case, even though the supply is very high? Probably not. So L&T will have to, since this is a niche requirement, also look into how they can meet up with those demands, because the demands are high. So over here, the interplay would not be elastic in an infinite manner. If the demand or if the pay has to be very high, then it will not function at the OW level. It might breach the level and go higher. All right. This theory is based on the Malthusian theory of population, according to which a rise in the wages above subsistence level will increase the population. But people might not think on that dimension. People may say, you know what, I may not bring up more than two children. I may not raise my family. It's already costly. So rather than that, I will improve my standard of living. So with the increment in the money, I may just go ahead and purchase something like a television, a vehicle or something, rather than just mindlessly increasing the population. So this is another constraint or a criticism to this particular theory. A few other points of criticism are that this theory does not explain the differences in the wages of workers having the same standard of living. Okay, so what this ideally means is that if people, okay, are getting the same wages, why do they have a different standard? Like some person might live in a very small room with his family, but some person might have a lavish accommodation. So what sets these two people apart is not put, or is not a scope of this particular theory. So if all laborers must get the bare necessities of life, all must get equal wages, but there are many differences in the wages, thus this theory ignores those wage differences. What about variable pay? What about some other incentive? This theory does not take. So it's slightly primitive in that context. It's a very basic theory. It explains adjustment of varies over a generation, but does not explain fluctuations on a more microscopic duration, that's a year to year. So what happens if the inflation turns into a hyperinflation, more inflation? Like let's say what has happened in Sri Lanka, what is currently happening in Bangladesh or Pakistan, where the fuel prices are rising. Their currency against the dollar is not performing really well. So what happens in such particular cases cannot be explained over here in this theory of subsistence. This theory is pessimistic because it excludes all possibility of improvement in the conditions of labor, okay, either through increased efficiency or due to general economic progress. So these dynamics in the modern or the contemporary conditions are beyond the scope of this theory, since it was created in the 18th century. This theory asserts that wages are fixed at the subsistence level. Therefore, it assumes that the trade unions are powerless. And this is wrong. As we've come to know, trade unions have held a good control if they are, you know, in prominent numbers, and they can have a bargaining effect. So essentially, if this is a floor of subsistence, the trade unions can ensure that people get more than subsistence. So this is despite more supply. So again, this theory fails to make an understanding at that level. Now we look at another theory, which is known as the wage fund or the wages fund theory. Was developed by a famous economist by the name of J.S. Mill. And according to this economist, this particular theory or the wage level is determined by the wage fund. So there is some sort of a fund created. So organizations, they have to create a pool of finance or a fund to pay the laborer. So they have to invest into some sort of a fund that is created. Okay, and once this fund is created, it has to be kept constant and payments have to be done from this particular fund. Now this fund is like a source of income for those particular laborers or workers employed. The wage level is given by the ratio of wage fund to the number of employees. So like, let's say if the fund is of a 1 crore rupees, and if there are 10,000 workers, so that 1 crore rupee fund will be divided by those workers to give the wages. Let's look at this in more detail. Now this is an example here, okay? So the wage fund, as specified earlier, so if you notice over here, this particular number, okay, like let's say it's to the tune of a 10 million probably, okay? So number of workers are 50,000, so the wage level will be divided by wage fund and it will be a 200. So a 10 million divided by a 50,000 will come up to a 200. Similarly, a 10 million, the same amount of fund divided by 100,000, which we know as a lakh, will come to something like 100 rupees. And the same amount divided by another increment would be reduced to 66.67. So as you can see, as the number of workers increase, the wage fund remaining constant, the wage level would go on decreasing. That is what it states over here, okay, in this particular table. Now, it is due to the constant wage fund distributed amongst more members that there is a decline in the eventual individual wage level, correct? So if we represent the wage level with respect to the number of workers employed, we will obtain something which is known as a convex curve, which we will see in the next discussion. So here is the convex curve. Okay, now this is plotted on the x-axis as an increment in the number of workers, as against the y-axis, which is increment in the wages. Now this is precisely what our previous table said. So this is essentially a downward sloped convex curve. Okay, a downward sloped convex curve. If you notice over here, okay, so if there is a 10 million fund and if there are only 500 employees, see the level of funds, they will each get much more. As this goes increasing, you will see the wages per person have dropped phenomenally. So here is our 66.67, where 10 million has to be divided or distributed amongst a good 15,000 employees. You might just want to pause the recording, the video, for some time to make sense, and then we will move ahead. The size of the fund could fluctuate over periods of time, but at any given moment, the amount was fixed. And the average wage could be determined simply by dividing the value of this fund by the number of workers. So this is known as the wage fund theory, a very simple sort of a theory which we could understand. Now, the next particular theory which we'll be looking at is the marginal productivity theory. So marginal productivity theory contributes a significant role in the factor pricing. So as we come to know, there are various factors which contribute to determining a wage model or a theory, which we'll come to know in the next pieces of discussion. So it's a theory invented by T.H. von Thunen, which is a German economist, all right? And this was further developed by other economists which have been mentioned over here. Now in this particular theory, okay, the demand for a specific factor of production is based on the marginal product of the factor. So a marginal product of the factor is determinant in devising the demand here. So the marginal productivity theory states that under conditions of perfect competition, every worker of the same skill and efficiency in a given category will receive a wage equal to the value of the marginal product. So if the labor produces something, they will get a certain factor of the production. This is the marginal productivity theory. So in any industry, what is a marginal product of labor? Let's understand this to further simplify and gain a better understanding of the theory. So what is it? It is nothing but the amount by which the output would be increased if one more man was employed while the quantities of other factors remained constant. Like, let's say we are in the process of manufacturing ceiling fans like Crompton Greaves, like Usha and other companies. Now what's happening is they have identified a certain shortfall of 50 units per day in one of their locations. Like, you know, the showrooms, the factory outlets, they're demanding, let's suppose in a month, 5,000 units of fans, and we are falling short of some 500, for example. So 4,500 of those fans are being shipped. Let's say Jaipur outlet is falling short of 500 units, you know, on an India level every month. And they've put an escalation or a complaint to the Usha factory. Now the Usha factory, which sends those units to the Jaipur outlet, has identified that 500 less pieces are being manufactured. So in this particular case, they would employ one more person rather than employing any specific equipment, any specific machine. So they would not employ that. So that is what is known as a marginal product of labor. Now, what is the factor over here? Is it a machine? Is it a skill? Is it AI? Is it a manager? No. It's an actual physical labor who is contributing. I believe this example has simplified and made you understand. So in short, it is the output of a single worker unaccompanied by any change. Everything remains the same. The same number of machines. So probably the worker would be in an overtime situation. So they might work an overtime through which they might achieve this particular aspect. Over here, we understand the marginal productivity theory through the help of this particular diagram. So as you can see in this figure, a number, okay, so the number of laborers is measured on the OX or the horizontal axis, as you can see here. So that's the number of laborers. Now, the wage rate is measured on the vertical or the OY axis. And like the previous model on subsistence, there is another line which is drawn here, which is a sort of an equilibrium, okay, where the average revenue productivity and the marginal revenue productivity. Now, what might be marginal? Marginal might be the additional productivity which is gained by that one extra worker. Okay, so I believe you've come to understand the concept of ARP. So ARP forms a curve like so, where if the number of workers or laborers are increased to some extent, it is also producing a corresponding increase in the wages, as you can see. So corresponding increase in the x-axis relates to an increase in the y-axis up to a certain equilibrium point. After breaching that point where there is a ceiling, it tends to drop over here, as you can see. So there is no influence of the number of laborers increasing the productivity. They might be a waste or a surplus. In this case, they might just be witnesses to what is happening, but they don't have any hand in producing the good or service. So over here, if you see, there is an equilibrium wage rate which will be determined at a point where both these factors tend to meet. So this is essentially the ARP and this is the MRP, okay? So the marginal rate, where slowly and steadily, what will happen is, it will not matter if you increase the numbers further, the wage rate would not increase in a proportion. That is what is looked up over here. So we continue our discussion about the marginal productivity theory. And as we've come to understand, we'll look at a few more aspects of the same diagram. So if the firm employs more workers than the OX, okay, it will have to face more losses or fewer profits. What's going to happen? The laborers are going to eat up into the revenues. Yeah, it's a logical thing, correct? So it's very logical that the more the number of laborers, the more distribution of wages will happen. Just imagine if your organization has 500 employees today and basis the profit, okay, a certain amount is given to each individual. Now, if suddenly there's an increment, and I'm talking about a manufacturing unit, if there's a sudden burst, then the employers will have to make more provisions. All right. So therefore, the ideal situation for a firm is to employ workers up to the point where ARP and MRP are equal. So if you notice over here, there is an optimal number of laborers. Okay, there's an optimal number of laborers working, and they are motivated to produce a specific amount of goods or certain sort of products. If this optimal number is breached, you will see that the employers will suffer. So the organizations will have to pay more, okay? And of course, subsequently, the wages of the laborers will also decline. Now we will look at the next theory, which is the bargaining power theory. So over here, we've already had, I think, a discussion in the previous chapter. We've had some discussions here. So bargaining basically is a part of the negotiation practices, where if I'm a buyer, I would like to buy cheap from a seller. I would expect to buy as cheap or inexpensive as possible. So for example, if I want to purchase a vehicle, I want to purchase, let's say, a car for about 12 lakhs. I want to upgrade my current car. Now, when I go to the showroom, I will not pay upfront the 12 lakhs. I am expecting to do some sort of a bargain. I'm asking for maybe an Apple, an upgrade to an Apple stereo system. So if there's a moonroof version which sells for 12 lakhs, I will see that I can get it for 11 and a half. Or if there's a 12 and a half, I will say, okay, you know what, my budget is 12. That 12 and a half lakh wala moonroof, please give it to me at 12 lakhs. Correct? So I will try to bargain either on the price, either on the value, either on any sort of maintenance. Like I will say, okay, 3 years warranty you're giving, or 3 years free service extended to 5 years. So there's something or the other I will try to bargain as a buyer of services. Correct? Similarly, the seller might put some premiums on their services as well. Okay? So the bargaining theory holds that the wages, the hours, and the working conditions are determined by the relative bargaining strength of the parties to the agreement. Now, in this case, it might be an individual worker with the employer. It might be a union, a trade union, with the management. So this essentially is the bargaining power theory. So the bargaining power theory was invented by an economist known as John Davidson and made famous in his book, The Bargain Theory of Wages, and stated that there are various factors which influence the wages in a bargain of the workers and producers. So under this theory, the more the worker is able to work, the more he gets paid. So there is a sort of a haggling, a negotiation, or a bargain that happens where the wages are said to be flexible according to the productivity demonstrated by that specific worker. Over here again, from a pictorial representation, we can understand better about this particular theory. So here in this figure, the term ARP, okay, which is the average net revenue, as you can see in this particular graph here, all right, it represents, so there is two things, ARP and the MRP. So the MRP represents the marginal net revenue, which is defined by this particular curved figure over here. Now, there are other terms which are the IC1, the IC2, 3, 4, and 5, which correspond, okay, which correspond and show certain differences or indifference curves at different wage rates. Okay, so they will remain constant at these particular wage rates, which are OW1, OW2, OW3, OW4, and OW5. Okay, now these are with respect to the satisfaction of the trade unions. Now, as we have come to know that the bargaining power theory corresponds to the perceptions of how much the worker deserves from the eyes of the trade unions. It can be seen from above that an increase in the wage rate, this is the vertical axis which denotes a low and a high wage rate. So increase in the wage rate would result in the increase of satisfaction levels. Okay, so this would be the satisfaction level of this particular, the boards or these particular trade unions. So this couples up, with the productivity and the satisfaction. So this is an axis which actually accommodates the satisfaction of the trade unions as well. Now in this case, the trade union would prefer the wage rate at a point P. Now if you see, point P is relatively high as a wage rate as compared to these particular points. So if you see, it's pretty high on that particular wage rate or the scale, where the indifference curve is tangent. If you see this particular indifference, this curve is tangent to ARP. So this is the ARP and this is that particular tangent, this indifference curve. So point P is basically a tangent or just one point on this particular curve. It is at the highest particular level. So at point P, the wage rate is OW4 and the number of laborers are OM. So this particular scale is low to high. So OM is the number of laborers currently working for the organization. So in this case, the wage rate goes up from OW4. So if it does move up from OW4, which is the indifference level here, if it moves from this level to an upper level, what would happen? The employer would suffer losses and they would need to shut down the factory because they are paying at a very high rate. Therefore, it is not beneficial for the employer as well as for the union. So it's not a win-win. This makes OW4 a sort of a ceiling or an upper benchmark, an upper limit for deciding on the wage rate. If this level is breached and it goes up to maybe an OW5, then it might not be lucrative for the owners or the employers to employ people at such an expensive rate. They would need to temporarily switch off or, bring the unit to a halt so that the people can, so there is some sort of a revision. So this is what is ideally a win-win for both the unions as well as the employers. If it breaches this and goes higher, then there would be a problem for the employers. You might want to just pause this, take a look again at the diagram or the figure to make sense, or rewind and again go through the discussion. Thank you.